Hi, I'm Leonard Lopate. Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, starts this Sunday evening, and many people celebrate with a big family meal. To help get you in the mood and inspire your meal planning, we're bringing you some great interviews from the past few years. In 2010, I chatted with Joan Nathan about the hidden culinary world she found when she searched for Jewish cooking in France. In 2013, I spoke with Deb Perlman about her cookbook, The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook, and she fielded listener calls as well. And then in 2014, Laura Silver described her round-the-world quest for the origins and modern-day manifestations of the Knish. Enjoy.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
You may be surprised to learn that France has the third largest Jewish population in the world behind the United States and Israel. Little has been written about what Jews in France are eating and what kind of impact they've had on French cuisine. But that's where Jewish food expert and James Beard Award winner Joan Nathan comes in. She's uncovered the secrets of what French Jews enjoy, from onion quiche to tarte flambé. She has written extensively on food over the years, has been the host of the PBS series Jewish Cooking in America with Joan Nathan. And this latest book is called Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France. It's published by Knopf. I'm very pleased that it brings her back to our show. Hi, Joan.
Hi. It's very nice to be here.
Now, you've written about American and Israeli food, but what got you thinking about Jewish food in France?
Well, I guess I started thinking about it a long time ago, not realizing, before I even thought about food as a subject to write about. When I was 17, my father sent me to France. He felt that a girl should learn a foreign language, and he was from Germany, came to the United States in 1929. And his relatives, who were from Germany, fled to France. So I stayed with them in Annecy, which is a beautiful town near Geneva, and I started eating. And I remember this one meal I had at their house where the first time that I sat down with them, and we had all these wonderful hors d'oeuvres variés and celery root remoulade, and it was just an amazing meal. And I had all these appetizers, and I ate all of them, of course, and a lot. And then the soup came out, and the stuffed veal came out, and the dessert came out, and I realized I'm in heaven. So I started thinking about French food. I never thought Jewish. And even when I spent my junior year abroad, no Jewish. And I think I had to go through everything else to come back to the food of the Jews of France.
Well, you did look out. Going to Annecy, that's near Burgundy, isn't it? And it's where Claire's Knee, if I remember, was filmed.
Very good, Leonard. Absolutely. It's beautiful.
But aren't most of the Jews in France in Paris?
Half of the Jews of France are in Paris. But because it's a history, 2,000-year-old history from Jerusalem, when they went from Jerusalem, the destruction of the Second Temple, to Rome, then they came to Catalonia, which was Spain. They also came to Provence, which is France, and also northern Italy. So there are Jews everywhere in France today.
Well, you write that the biggest impediment to talking about Jewish cooking is that Jewish food is mostly diasporic.
Well,
you're talking about people coming from the Eastern Europe and the from Spain and from North Africa. The only thing they have in common is that they're Jewish.
Well, yes and no, because first of all, the dietary laws, even if you do not follow the dietary laws, they're in the back of your head, imprinted somewhere. And so that's one thing that makes it Jewish. Then, of course, where they're from is very important to what cooking they do. And where they live is another. I mean, for all of us. And the traditional foods are the foods that come out for holidays and the Sabbath. So that some traditional foods of the Jews of France that have lived there, maybe their families, for 2,000 years, come out in different ways. For example, Jews that lived in Alsace always made for Shabbat and also for the Jewish holidays, either a carpe à la juive, which had a parsley sauce, or a sweet and sour sauce. Well, in Taiwan, 14th century, I was reading about this parsley sauce and the sweet and sour sauce, which is no longer used in France, but it still is used by the Jews of France because it's an old recipe and one that is repeated for holidays. So that's where you find...
This is because of tradition.
You have to dig to find the recipes, and you also have to dig for people to talk about being Jewish.
Well, it's interesting that your subtitle or your title is Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, because quiches I associate with France,
right.
Kugels I associate with Germany or Eastern Europe, and couscous I associate with North Africa.
Well, quiche I did because it is quintessentially French, but Jewish quiche doesn't have lardon or ham in it. Okay, so the onion quiche that you would have has no ham in it. Kugel, because kugel is a German word, and it started in Alsace, which was originally called Ashkenaz, and that's where Ashkenazic food began, in this valley between France and Germany. So kugel, which means round, used to be in a clay pot, really, upside down flower pot, looked like, that it was a sort of a bread pudding next to the hot like the cholent, but for their cholent would have been a pot-au-feu in the fire for the Sabbath meal. It was a second dish. And of course, these were poor people, so they'd have a kind of bread pudding. But what they did was, it's fabulous. I have the recipe in my book. They'd saute some onions and put pears in it. And then they'd serve it with a fruit compote. It's wonderful. So I thought kugel, because that's where all the Jews from Alsace lived. And before the revolution, there were 150 villages in Alsace where there were Jews living. And most of them after the revolution, when Jews could live wherever they wanted to, went to Paris. And couscous, because after 1959, 1960, 61, when Morocco, Tunisia, and Algeria were independent, about 100,000 Jews from North Africa came to Paris. Today, there are about 250, which is almost half the population of the Jews of France. And they have couscous for Shabbat. And so I thought, quiche, kugel, and couscous, why not?
Well, there is also, you go to a store now and there are separate couscouses that are called Israeli couscouses.
Right, but that's
it's a different
couscous.
Bead.
That's a really interesting breed, because after the independence of Israel, Ben-Gurion realized that there was no couscous for all these Jews coming from North Africa. So he asked Osem, this Czechoslovakian noodle company, to create a noodle that looked like couscous, which they called Ben-Gurion couscous. And that's where it began.
My guest is Joan Nathan, whose latest book is Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France. It's published by Knopf. And you say that when you ask people, French Jews, about Jewish cooking, they said that they didn't know of any Jewish dishes.
Right. Some of them did. Some of them wouldn't really talk to me. Others found dishes that they had been using in their family for so many generations, and they just thought they were familiar, that they were not necessarily Jewish, even though they were practicing Jews. So, and they also didn't know, for example, that the Jews brought chocolate to France. The Jews from the Southwest brought it after the Inquisition as a drink, not as a candy.
Because it had come to Spain when they conquered Mesoamerica.
Right. And also after that, many of them went to the New World and learned about all these dishes and these ingredients, like tomatoes and peppers, potatoes, and chocolate. And so they brought that to France. And the Jews became the best chocolate makers. So, you find different kinds of challah, for example, which is a cousin of the brioche. And in fact, when I went to synagogue, people there, and where there was a challah, I could hear all these people saying, oh, what a beautiful brioche.
Mm-hmm. You write that Jewishness of the Jews in France is somewhat hidden. What do you mean? Is this a legacy from what happened during the German occupation during World War II?
I think it's a legacy of the history of the Jews of France and the history of the Jews of Europe, really.
But Jews have been prominent in French history in a way that they haven't been in many other European countries.
Absolutely.
For example, Léon Blum was the prime minister before World War II, and then Mendes France was prime minister afterward, both Jewish. On the other hand, there was very virulent anti-Semitism in France before and during the occupation.
Well, I think that the French in general are much more reserved than Americans. And I think that the Jews in particular, because of the Holocaust, because of the Dreyfus affair, because of expulsions through the centuries, have just been a lot quieter. And you know, but that's the way the French are too.
The French have embraced the cuisines of other countries as well. What we think of as French cuisine has a lot of Italian influences, a lot of Spanish influences. What about Jewish influences?
Well, I think the Jewish influences are more in what ingredients were brought to France by the Jews. For example, the Jews brought carp to France from China. They brought spices from India. They brought chocolate. But then, there, as I said, brioche is a cousin. Chopped liver is a form of pâté. So that what they did was they would adjust recipes to Jewishness. They also, like matzo balls, little dumplings, they brought them. They're not big matzo balls the way we had it, but little matzo balls. And I remember that when I was at a dinner where somebody was making pot-au-feu and tiny little matzo balls, all the French were so excited to eat these, where in America, you would never think that that was something very special. So, but it's sort of, and a lot of the old Jewish recipes, I'll give you an example, fougasse. Fougasse was the challah. In the middle ages. So what's first, fougasse for the French or for the Jews? I don't know. I think it's all lost in history. They might have been simultaneous, one ad-libbed from the other. But, you know, people had common markets way back when in France, so that, and also common ovens, public ovens. So you'd go to an oven and you'd see what your neighbors were bringing to the oven. And so recipes traveled. You know, eggplant dishes are really considered Jewish in France, for example.
Although not anymore. This is like artichokes in Italy.
Right, exactly. Way back. And you know, even artichokes in Italy, I'm not sure they're Jewish, actually, the artichoke alla Judea. If you go to Spain, you see those in every marketplace. So it's really hard to pinpoint historically.
You point out that recipes were handed down before the 20th century through handwritten cookbooks that went from mother to daughter. Do any of those still exist?
Oh, lots. And lots of – I'll give you an example of a recipe that I think is quite wonderful. It's a Jewish apple cake. Now, we know it as a recipe that I found in Christian cookbooks in the United States where it had oil instead of butter. And my husband's family brought it from Poland to the United States. But in America, we have more flour, more sugar than what they have in France. So France, the same recipe came from Poland to France. And it's the way that they start the recipe is you taste the apple. And then there might be some almond extract in it and ground almonds. It just has that French touch to it that we just don't have in the recipes that we have in America.
Do they have anyone like Joe Nathan putting together French cuisine for Jews?
I don't think they really do. I don't think they understand what's right there. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, there's so much, and there's so many old recipes that that's why I had such a good time.
Well, what would a typical Sabbath meal be like in France?
It depends on the family.
They come from originally?
Right. And what's interesting is the North African Jews are marrying Ashkenazic Jews, and the North African food is winning all the time. So, you know, a North African Shabbos dinner would have at least 15 salads first, cooked salads with, you know, things like olives and always an eggplant salad. You always have to have an eggplant salad. There's a wonderful salade juive, which is cooked down tomatoes that's so delicious. And then there'd be couscous.
Does this apply to the Seder as well?
It depends on who's cooking. And the Seders that I went to were French Jewish. And I remember when I first went to a Seder when I was very, very young, and we had haroset. And I thought, wait a minute, this isn't my mother's haroset. It was apples and nuts, but it was a little bit finer ground than my mother's. And you always think of Shabbos or the holidays your mother's food. And when it's a little bit different, the matzo balls were broken matzah, and they had ginger and nutmeg in them, which is sort of like what I have, but this was Alsatian. And even Friday night when I was living there, it's not this way anymore, we'd have two baguettes as the challah. Today they have all kinds of challah, and wonderful challah with anise in it and from North Africa, and less sweet because everything's less sweet in France.
A listener asks about quiches, points out that, of course, you can't have any meat in something right. that has cheese. But do they have any meat quiches without cheese?
Not that I know of. Not that I know of.
By the way, we have a number of recipes from your book on our show page so people can get a sense of what we're talking about. The Alsatian pear kugel with prunes.
Oh, my favorite recipe in the book. Good.
Moroccan chicken with olives and preserved lemons.
Yum.
And lots more. All from Joe Nathan's latest book, which includes 200 recipes and their stories. It's called Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France, published by Knopf. And we should point out it also has pictures in it, which is always important because you do want to have a sense of where the food is coming from and what the food should look like. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ever since Deb Perlman launched it in 2006, the Smitten Kitchen blog has developed a major cult following. Late last year, her first book, called The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook, was published by Knopf. It quickly became a bestseller. And if the reaction of our listeners when they heard that she was coming back to our show is any indication, Deb, her blog, and her book remain incredibly popular. Welcome back to our show.
Well, thank you. That's quite an introduction.
You've described yourself as obsessive. Do you think that one of the reasons that your recipes are so popular is that you're obsessive in crafting them to work?
I hope so. It's a little bit of the obsessiveness is trying to get them to work, and a little bit of the obsessiveness is trying to get them to work for home cooks. This idea that, you know, so many of our recipes are written by chefs and restaurant cooks, and they make amazing, incredible food. But when you're at home, the rules are different. You don't want to have to do 20 pieces of prep or use three pots or two bowls. And so I'm always asking, like, can we make this cake in one bowl? Do we have to brown? Like, does it change the final dish enough that it's worth an extra dirty dish?
Also, I think I go to a restaurant for the kinds of food that I don't cook at home. Often the ingredients that I won't necessarily use at home, I'm looking for something different at home.
Exactly. One of the things I love at restaurants is, like, sometimes I'll just get one of those salads with eight vegetables in them. I mean, I have vegetables around my apartment, but I don't usually make eight vegetable salads on a weekday night. It would make enough that you'd be eating it for 2 weeks. So little things like that.
Well, since you're not inventing these recipes, how obsessive are you in the hunt for the best recipe for, let's say, roast chicken or egg salad?
Well, I've hardly invented roast chicken, but the recipes in the book are actually originally my recipes. But, you know, original is a complicated thing. I did not invent roast chicken. But what I'm thinking about a lot with roast chicken is
Somebody
did, and I thank 5, them.
5,000 years ago.
Oh, I know. They just put it over a fire, and everybody was happy. But when I've been looking at a lot of roast chicken recipes over the years, because who doesn't love roast chicken every so often, is they take a long time. You know, you do the whole bird. Sometimes you have to trust them, and most people aren't going to do that on a weekday night. And let's say it's a freezing day in February, and you would love to have roast chicken for dinner. Could it be done in under an hour? And from there, I learned about spatchcocking, which is this hilarious word where you just cut out the backbone of a chicken, and boom, I mean, a small chicken, you can do it in 30, 40 minutes.
Does it affect the flavor? Doesn't the bone give some flavor to
Absolutely.
The chicken?
Absolutely, and you still have a lot of bones in there. But the nice thing is it increases the skin surface area by being flat, that you get a lot more crisp skin, I think, with this method. And then you can save the backbone for stock. So you do this 3 or 4 times. You put it in the freezer in a bag, and then you can use those to make stock down the road. It's very useful.
And you admit to going through 7 different muffin recipes before you landed on the plum poppy seed muffin recipe in the book. We happen to have that recipe on our show page at WNYC.org. Did you learn anything from the 6 muffin recipes that you rejected?
Yes. I learned that that a lot of muffin recipes are really way too sweet. One of the things I'm always trying to do is try to keep muffins on the breakfast side of the breakfast cake line. And so if you're going to have something really sweet or with a ton of butter in it, it's just sort of like it's just cake. And I want to believe that it's breakfast. And so I discovered that, you know, thicker batters keep the fruit from sinking. So with thinner batter, you're going to have all that fruit in the bottom at the end. But if you want it nicely interspersed, it's good to keep it a little thicker.
I wish some professional bakers knew that. You often wind up with a blueberry muffin with all the blueberries on the bottom.
So sad, because the muffin top is totally the best part, too. But yeah, you know, in most cases, you can put in yogurt and at least a good part of whole wheat flour, and it still can taste really good without being overly austere, because you do want to treat once in a while.
Do you think it's important to share the failures with your readers as well as the successes?
Absolutely. Though these days I tend to couch it in, here are some things that went wrong on my way to getting here, rather than just leaving people at a dead end. But I love it, because I think that we all go through that. Or maybe people imagine that if you have successful recipes in a book that you've never had 15 flops on your wing to get there. And I mess up all the time in the kitchen.
What about your readers? They write back to you on your blog.
Very often.
Did they say, Deb, I tried this. Let me suggest another approach.
Let me suggest you go to cooking school. And
no, they're
so
not that mean.
Most of them are very lovely. So I'm very lucky. Most of the feedback is positive. But I tend to feel like I'm playing doctor with symptoms when something goes wrong, because I really want to figure it out, because I want to know what's going on in people's kitchen. It's very helpful for me to hear why it did or did not work. But I often don't know when somebody says, this didn't work. I'm like, well, how? Tell me more.
Well, you began as an amateur. Did that help you keep an open mind when you started cooking?
I think so. I didn't have any idea of what a correct recipe was. I wasn't really concerned with the proper way to do everything. And in many cases, I find it helpful to know the correct way, but then you figure out where you can deviate from there.
And the correct way isn't always the correct way. Sometimes people will say, you know, the tradition is to sear the meat first, or mm-hmm. to cook it on one side first and then on the other side. But maybe that's not always the best approach. We are still learning how to cookie, despite the fact that humans have been doing it since before they developed language.
I agree. And I also think, you know, sometimes it's a matter of priority. Like maybe you don't care that much about whether it has that extra crunch from the searing. I think a good recipe writer is going to question all of those things. They're going to say, is this absolutely necessary? Can I make this both ways and take away the searing and see if we really miss it?
Did you learn from your parents?
I learned a lot from my parents. My mom definitely was she taught herself to cook through working her way through mastering the art of French cooking, which I love because it's such a classic. So I probably had an above average amount of quiche and asparagus in my life for a Jewish kid from New Jersey. But I learned a bit, and my grandmother was very into baking. She was an excellent baker. But I think most of it I've just sort of figured out through trial and error, because I'm actually really picky. And so it's sort of like I think I don't like something, and then I challenge myself to make it in a way that I would.
You say that in your blog that you're wary of excessively fussy foods and or pretentious ingredients. That part of your pickiness?
I think that's part of it, but that's also part of my frustration with a lot of the recipes I read. I don't know when this became okay, but all of a sudden I feel like I read recipes all the time that say, use the best olive oil. I'm like, are you kidding me? We're frying an egg. The best olive oil should be used to finish a dish. Or in your own kitchen, you can make these choices. But the idea that you would make it a prerequisite for somebody to make your dish that they have some fancy sea salt, and I do have a couple that I'm quite soft for, too. But, you know, to really question whether table salt would work there, not to use the lowest common denominator ingredient so that more people can make it. And if they want to go swap in their favorite olive oil they brought back from their trip to Italy, they can, but it shouldn't be a prerequisite.
My guest is Deb Perlman. Her book, The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook, has become a major bestseller. As a picky eater, that means that there are certain things that you don't like to eat or have. I mean, you're writing cookbooks. So do you have to trick yourself into eating something that you wouldn't have eaten otherwise?
Yes, sometimes. But I didn't publish anything I didn't feel was a good result, because there were things like I thought I didn't like meatloaf. who likes me? It's like this slab on a plate. But then I played with it, and I realized they were kind of just like large meatballs. And, well, that's actually how I ended up making it, kind of like large meatballs. So you have these individual servings, and they don't have that brown slab look. And the flavor is, I actually really love it. So I converted myself through my challenge.
And what about fish? A lot of people have problems with fish.
This is like my deep dark shame is that I'm not the most enthusiastic fish eater.
Why? It's delicious.
I know. It's not logical. I don't actually think it tastes bad. It's just like it's totally beyond logic, because obviously, you know, a beautiful piece of fish with a brown butter and lemon juice. I'm not crazy. I know that's delicious.
Well, some people object to the smell when the fish is cooking.
I think that I can smell it even when it's super fresh and a million miles away. But the strangest thing is, you know, most people would say, I'm not really into fish, but I like salmon or shrimp. Those are the two things that I have the hardest time getting my head around. But I love, like, the things that most people don't like mussels and clams, and I don't even mind oysters. So I probably like the fishiest things.
And then we just learned in today's times that much of what is being called snapper isn't snapper.
Yes. I mean, when you can't see where your food's coming from, the idea that you can just trust it, unfortunately, hasn't been shown to be the case in many, many, many other foods besides this.
Well, okay, so let's say you had a recipe for snapper and somebody went to the local supermarket, bought something that was labeled snapper, turned out to be something totally different. Isn't that going to ruin the recipe, or are all oily fishes alike in a sense?
I think that it depends on whether the recipe writer anticipated it, and of course what was being used as a replacement. Is it a consistent replacement? If you're a recipe writer and you know that a lot of snapper is something else, it would do good to mention this in the head notes and also test it both ways.
In light of the success of your blog and the sales of your cookbook, can you consider yourself a food expert now?
Oh, God, no. Not at all. I think the only thing I understand with anything more than the most pedestrian level of knowledge is maybe how people I talk to cook at home.
Well, you've said that there aren't bad cooks. There are bad recipes.
I think so. I think that a really good recipe, you should be able to walk into the kitchen with this recipe in your hand, know very little about cooking, and just follow it beginning to end and have something exactly like the recipe creator intended. That was what a good recipe should do.
So do you start off with the foods that you did love?
I start off with an idea. Sometimes it's a whim that just came to me when I was like staring at the window and supposed to be doing my work. Other times it's something I had at a restaurant that I really loved. And I don't want the chef's recipe. It's just like, wow, I hadn't even considered putting these two things together. And then I just like my – and sometimes it's just like, you know, I bet I would like meatloaf if it had this in it. And then I start playing. So it usually comes from a place of tinkering.
Do you think very seasonally? Most people, when they talk about seasonal things, they're thinking about the vegetables of the time. But does winter mean pastas to you? Or
absolutely. And we're definitely –
stews, beans?
Absolutely. Doing a lot more stews, beans. I feel like I eat more meat in the winter, too, just because, you know, it's much harder to base an entire it's absolutely possible, but it's a little trickier when the produce isn't that lovely to build an entire recipe, you know, entire meal around just a vegetable that's not so great right now.
And there are certain things that intimidate home cooks. How do you entice people to take the chance?
Well, I think that, you know, I know a lot of people are intimidated by homemade pasta, pie dough, tart doughs,
pizza
frosting.
Crusts.
Some people are intimidated by layer cakes. Whatever it is, I think if you know why it intimidates people, if you can figure out where it is that people are just like, you know, losing it, where they just – look, if you don't feel like there's any difference between the flavor of your favorite box cake mix and what you're making at home, absolutely do not bother yourself. This is not judgment. It's like, don't bother. It has to be worth it to you. But if you were thinking that there could be better, but you just think that all the recipes are too complicated or you've had so many that fall flat, that's where the place where a good recipe can come in.
One of the things that I like about the book is that you've done the meatless main courses separate from the meat dishes. I'm assuming – that's because you were once a vegetarian, or you have thought about the plight of vegetarians?
I was a vegetarian for a very long time. I was a very opinionated 13-year-old, as I guess shouldn't be terribly surprising. And I was a vegetarian all the way until the time that shortly after I met my husband and he ruined me. or something. But I
well, you could have cooked food, meat for him. And
well, he's actually totally okay. It's great because he's not like, you know, he's not like, oh boy, we're having Brussels sprouts and potatoes for dinner. Like, he's not sad at all if we don't have. I mean, he loves meat, but it's not like, you know. So he was going to eat either way. But I think it just, I started thinking, what do I not like about it? What would make me like it if I knew I could get clean meat, ethically raised, and I didn't eat it all the time, and I made it in ways I'd like it? So it sort of came around that way. But because of that, I think my orientation towards meat meals has changed, hopefully permanently. I think it's a good thing because most of the time I'm not looking for meat when I'm making a meal. I'm looking for it as a once or twice a week or a special occasion kind of thing.
And in many ethnic cuisines, meat, when it is used, is really just another flavoring. Mm-hmm. It is not the dominant thing and dominant ingredient as it is in a lot of American cooking.
Absolutely. And that's a luxury, this idea of being able to have large pieces of meat for each person. You know, I always think of like with, I don't know, carnitas or like a pork shoulder, you know, which just stretched for many, many meals. Or I made some really good stuffed cabbage where, you know, you take the ground meat, you take like 1 pound or a third of a pound of meat and you stretch it to meals for many people, hearty, wholesome meals.
My guest is Deb Perlman, who's a self-taught home cook and photographer who created smittenkitchen.com, which started winning a lot of awards. It's a blog that then led to her cookbook, which is includes only a few of the recipes that she has published on her blog. But the cookbook has become a major bestseller for Knopf. The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook, Recipes and Wisdom from an Obsessive Home Cook. One of the reasons it's so popular is because of your text that goes along with the recipes. It's not just the recipes. And when we come back, we'll talk a bit about that. Okay?
Thank you.
And we're back with Deb Perlman, her book, The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook, a bestseller from Knopf, Recipes and Wisdom from an Obsessive Home Cook is the subtitle that Knopf gave you. I'm sure you didn't give them that, with lots of wonderful pictures. When you were here on the show last time, a listener named Sandy called in to ask a question or wrote into our show page that we couldn't get to it, but it is a very common question, so I'm going to ask it for her now. What are great weekday meals for a rushed household with kids that also incorporate vegetables that they'll eat?
Wow. I'm a big fan of making baked vegetable dishes, gratins. Now, I know when we think of gratins, we think of them oozing with cream and cheese. They absolutely do not need to be. They can be with broth. You can put a little bit of cheese in, or maybe just – there are a lot – it's basically just baked vegetables. And what's nice is when you do something like that, it's very delicious. It reheats really well. And you could make a pan of something with a lot of vegetables in the beginning of the week and use it throughout the week. I have – it's more rice-based, but I have a wild rice gratin in the cookbook, which is – it has kale and caramelized onions and a little bit of cheese, and it's with broth, not cream. And I just – we love making that. So now you have this hearty, healthy side dish for the whole week.
And you could take care of that kale that – seems to be proliferating
everywhere.
In every market.
Exactly.
And we say, what the heck do you do with that?
What did we do before kale? I think we just starved, I guess.
Well, most of the dishes you have in the book and in the blog are from scratch. Do you object to people cutting corners with things like canned beans or frozen peas?
Oh, my goodness. Not at all. I feel like as a recipe creator and a curious cook, I like to give people the tools to make things from scratch. But absolutely, I mean, you need to use pre-bought pie dough, or you just cannot bear to make your own pizza dough or whatever. It's individual choice, and I really resist and kind of resent the idea that somebody should be judged for that. Everybody picks what's important to them in the kitchen.
But do you think that making things from scratch does have a little difference when it comes to taste?
I think it does, but I think that not everybody is, you know, everybody's got their, you know, some people don't feel like there's a big difference in the pie dough when they make it, and so I'm obviously not one of these people. I think it tastes much better, but if you don't, then, you know, you shouldn't feel like you need to bother yourself with it just for somebody else's standards of what pie dough should be. But I also just also enjoy being in the kitchen. I'm not trying to create 30-minute recipes, not because I have no respect for your time, but because I actually enjoy the process. And I think if you'd like to be in the kitchen, you know, and if you there are ways that you can bring your family in and bring your kids in and enjoy it, you don't need to rush out of there.
Should invite our listeners to participate in this, because I know a lot of people have questions for you. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org or tweet us. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Also, you can reach us through Facebook. My guest is Deb Perlman. Her book, The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook, is from Knopf, and it's been a bestseller. Does that mean there'll be a follow-up?
I'm not working on a follow-up.
You're just in the blog.
Kicking off my second book tour for the book, so I'm going to be like all over the country in the next 2 weeks. So anyway, so I haven't even thought about it. Maybe one day, but I don't want to write another book just because it's time to write another book. I want to write another book because I have a really great book to write.
But there are only 100 recipes in the book, and in the blog you have many hundreds.
Yeah, there are over 800 recipes on the site and more each week.
So how did you decide which dishes to put into the book?
Sometimes it was very clear to me, like there was just something that just screamed book to me. And sometimes for me that was something where I thought it had more longevity, or maybe it didn't focus so much on an ingredient with a very short window of being in season, and or that was hard to get. I love ramps. They're so delicious, but they're most people in the country can't get them. And even in New York, they have a very short window. And sour cherries is another thing. So I don't really, I wasn't terribly interested in putting them in the cookbook, even though I enjoy cooking with them.
So this isn't necessarily a reflection of your specific tastes and the trigger foods that you talk about.
Not necessarily. I mean, there are definitely things that don't show up on the site as much or in my recipes, just because I feel like they're harder to get, or sometimes where I feel like the everyday quality is really quite different from what I'm getting, and I don't want people to be disappointed.
Well, you have a whole section in the book on how to throw a dinner party that you will actually enjoy. That's a big problem, isn't it? Guests come and you wind up doing in the kitchen a lot while everybody else is having fun. It's hard to come up with something where you can also participate.
I agree. And I think that there's a lot of foods that can be made in advance and reheat really well. There are foods that taste better on the second and third day. And these are the places that I think you should go with your creative energies, unless you were trying to do something very fancy and highly ambitious. Most people I know are absolutely delighted to get invited over for meatballs and spaghetti, or let's make some deep dish pizza, or just like here's some short rib braise. You know, they've been settling for a day, and you rewarm it, and it's incredible. Like, this is that kind of comfort food. Most people aren't cooking at home, and this is a luxury just to have somebody make you dinner.
So you're saying that it's not important to show off.
No,
it's important to have the social experience.
Yes, I think showing
Got
off.
That short ribs aren't a very special kind of dish.
Well, no, I think it can be special and have profound, intense flavor and be really wonderful meal without you maybe exhausting yourself to do something so ambitious that it was difficult for you, and therefore your enjoyment of it may not be as much.
Many, many New Yorkers complain about the size of their kitchen. Do you think there are advantages to cooking in a small kitchen?
I think there are, and this is like me chinning up about it, because I have a very tiny kitchen, and it's incredibly annoying, but...
Well, you started off with a tiny kitchen, then you moved to another place with a tiny kitchen. I would have thought you would have moved to a place with a bigger kitchen.
I make no sense at all. I know. There's no logic, so I'm not allowed to complain about it, because I did choose it. Nobody held a gun to my head and said I had to live in an overpriced apartment with a tiny kitchen. I liked the living room. So there you go. I liked the size of the bedroom. I liked the black and white tiles on the floor. So I'm not logical, but yes, my first kitchen when I started the site was actually bigger. I moved to a smaller one, but I have found it useful in reining in my more complicated ideas, because as soon as something hits three bowls, like, forget it. I'm out of room and I'm getting stressed out and I'm not enjoying it.
What about other kitchen equipment? The mixers and the blenders and all of that stuff, toasters and I don't know.
I'm resistant to using them. I have
microwave.
Picked up. I don't have a microwave. I'm not like anti-microwave. It's a big box, and I just for most things, I've found that I can just use the oven or use the stove, and so I just decided that was something I didn't want. I use instead the space I would have put the microwave in. I do actually have the mixer and all that stuff, but I don't take it down for everything. I've discovered that with like 95% of the things I would use a stand mixer for, I can really use an inexpensive hand mixer.
And a food processor?
I can't live without it. I think that you can live without it, but it saves you so much chopping, and you can make so many things in it so quickly.
You've been writing the blog for 7 years now. Has your approach changed over all that time?
Oh, my God. It's been almost 7 years. Sorry. You're right. I think it's gotten maybe I've become even more of a pain with the testing because as the readership has grown, my worry about disappointing people has it's not that the early recipes aren't well tested, but I feel like things are far more rigorous now, and I'm a lot pickier with the results.
And when did you decide you had to quit your day job to devote yourself totally to this?
Well, it wasn't a hard choice. I wasn't very good at my day job. I'm sure they weren't like, that Deb Perlman, we've never been able to replace her. I'm sorry. I like to talk about it because I think a lot of people, when you get out of college and you're just like, what am I going to do with my life? And I'm so bad at my job. I think this is like normal. And a lot of us have to bounce around a lot before we find something that we really love. Anyway, for me, it was like, because, you know, I was really working on the site every evening and on the weekends, and I was working all day. I had two jobs, but it was just a matter, for me, I didn't have a very fancy, or I wasn't like a six-year associate or anything like that, so I had a pretty paltry salary, so it was just about a matter of the site making more money than my day income was.
Well, there are a lot of people who started cooking blogs. Why do you think this one took off the way so many others haven't?
I think my mom pays everybody to hang out with me. It's really hard for me to see it from the outside. I know what I'm trying to do, but you know what it means to other people is like very hard for me to read. But I'm hoping that I'm putting out recipes that work, things that you're really wanting to eat that aren't too complicated.
But what are your readers telling you? I know you answer all of the emails that they write to you. You've been on tour. You say this is the second one. The book debuted at number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list for hardcover advice and miscellaneous. So you must be getting a lot of feedback.
I'm not that good with email these days, but I do try to respond to every comment that has a question in it. I'm hearing that I have friends who never cook. I mean, I mentioned in the introduction, I have friends that use their ovens for sweater storage. And maybe it's just they're being nice because it's my book, but all of them are cooking now. And it really means a lot to me. They're making brisket on the weekends, and they're just, and I'm hearing from them. So I'm hoping that maybe if you thought you were somebody who didn't really, who found cooking to be a little bit drudgery, maybe there were some ideas in there that made you immediately want to go to the kitchen and just make one thing.
What about the photography? Did that also... Is that something that you discovered you liked at the same time you discovered that you wanted to write about food?
No, the photography is much later. I really picked up a camera for the first time besides a point and shoot in 2005 when I borrowed my husband's camera, and I haven't given it back yet. Sorry. Not sorry.
I'm sure he's not sorry.
He's over it.
Does he have to test all of the food that you're writing recipes for?
I don't think he minds that much, but yes, he does. It depends.
It was
yes.
worth sacrificing a camera.
Yes. I gave it back to him when I upgraded, and he's like, thanks. the photography for me is secondary. I know what I'm trying to do with the photos. I don't really consider myself consider myself a fake photographer. I don't know anything about lights or metering, or my white balancing is atrocious. I'm trying to get sharp pictures of the food so you can see what it really looks like in my kitchen.
But you also have to make the food look good. There are people out there who do that for a living.
I know. I wish one of them would come over and make my photos look better. But you know what, though? I think food styling is amazing, and there are people who do incredible jobs, and I'm envious of their skills. At the same time, I feel like there's something to food the way we're actually serving it. You know, chicken on a dinner plate. Like, because that's how we're eating. That's how it looks at home. And if I were to put out something really ambitious and beautiful and maybe perfectly styled, your food wouldn't look like that. And how would that inspire you? I feel disappointed.
How did you wind up at Knopf, which has this great tradition Julia Child, Marcella Hazan, and Judith Jones. Did somebody spot the blog and say, Deb, we think you should give us a book?
I think what happened, I don't know the exact how it came happened at Knopf, and I know at a few of the publishers I visited, it was sort of like the editor maybe hadn't heard of it, but then they mentioned it to like their younger office assistant, and they were you have to get her in. And so I don't know if that's exactly how it went down, but I wouldn't have been surprised. And I don't know how I ended up there, but I've been so happy with them. So
where do you get inspiration for what recipe or dish you're going to tackle next? Does it start with thinking, what are we going to have for dinner?
It does. It starts with cravings. I've been, because I was away so much over the fall book touring, I've been home for a month and a half now, and I've been really cracking down on dinner. Like, I don't want to eat takeout. I don't want to eat. So I've been cooking a ton in the last month and a half. And a lot of it, I'm like, oh, I'm just going to throw some chicken in the oven. I'm just going to make a quick soup. And I can't help it. My brains are always spinning. I made a quiche, and I'm like, ooh, I have another, you know, so it spins into another idea. So lately my inspiration has been this stuff I've been cooking for dinner, just not trying to do anything fancy, but ideas come from there. But quite often it just comes from hunger or cravings or just whatever looked good at the store, which is not so much this time of year.
Do listener comments ever inspire a recipe?
Oh, absolutely. One of my favorite...
Or reader, I guess, comments. Yeah. I think in terms of listeners, but you have
maybe
readers.
I hope they're listening, too. one of my favorites is somebody told me they made... I have this thing called it. It's a chocolate loaf cake, and I call it the everyday chocolate cake, though. Sadly, I never get to eat it every day. Maybe it's for the best. Anyway, so she said that she didn't have buttermilk, and she used red wine, and that was it. I was like, she didn't even like it that much, but it didn't matter. I was halfway to the kitchen. and I love it. And there's actually a lot of chocolate red wine cakes. I want to say like maybe northern France. I've heard about them. So they actually exist in cookbooks long before this, but I loved it with a pinch of cinnamon in there. And it makes a really delicious, really fun dinner party cake that's easy to make.
Well, people often drink red wine when they're eating chocolate or some chocolate dessert. So the pairing makes sense, but you're just putting them into the thing itself.
Exactly. What I love about the cake is I feel like it tastes equally of red wine and chocolate. The red wine is definitely, it is a background flavor, but it's present. And what you end up with is a very red chocolate cake. I consider it the real red velvet cake.
So are there things that you won't try? Do you stay away from breads, for example?
No, I love baking bread. In fact, I actually think it's a little bit absent from the book, but quite often, when I'm making bread, I'm really using other people's recipes. I'm not a professional bread baker, and so I would use what Peter Reinhardt's doing or, you know, somebody who, Jim Leahy's bread. Like, I'm not really doing a lot of my own bread inventions, but I love making bread. But I don't make bread for a dinner party, and I don't make bread because it's Sunday morning. I'll make bread because... As an additional project.
Jim Leahy's No Need Bread has been a revelation for a lot of people.
I really like it.
Yeah, there's a layered crepe cake that you have in your cookbook. It's hard enough to make one crepe, let alone a stack of them. How did you crack the nut of making good crepes, a sequence of good crepes?
Well, my recipe anticipates that you are going to lose one or two, which is nice because you are the first. Because you're just like out of the rhythm. I feel like after you make two, though, you do get into the rhythm of it. However, I think that their crepes can really they can range, and there are very thin, lacy, delicate ones, and they are absolutely wonderful for somebody else to make. They are the most difficult to make at home without tearing. So I go for a batter that's just has a little bit more body in it, and I think the people find it a lot easier. So it won't be as thin as a filmy piece of lace, but it will also be something that I think you can pull off easily at home.
Now, we have three of your recipes on our show page. Plum poppy seed muffins, pancetta white bean and Swiss chard pot pies, and tre leche rice pudding.
Good choices.
Oh, I was hoping that you thought that they would be good choices, but there are so many we could have chosen from.
But those are good for this time of year. That white bean pot pie, you know, it's just so great as a cold winter meal. It's really like a nice stew. It's vegetarian. There's pancetta in it. The pancetta is optional. If you eat it, go ahead, throw it in. If you don't want to, it's still a nice white bean
stew. Can you put something else in that will capture that same kind of salty meat flavor?
I think you can, but you know, I always have a hard time. I get this question a lot, like, what's bacon like but not bacon? I'm like, I don't know. You can use a fake bacon, but I would be more likely to maybe just add some smoked paprika, you know, for a little bit of the smoky saltiness. There are definitely ingredients that some people feel work. I haven't found one that I feel is a arguable good replacement, but I also made that recipe both ways, and we really liked it with or without it.
The book is The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook. Been a bestseller for how long now? A while. When was it published?
It came out October 30th. I think it was on for 10 weeks, maybe more. And then if I say I lost track, I sound like such a jerk, but I might have lost track. Sorry.
Well, you can find it at your local bookstore. It's published by Knopf. And Deb, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me back.
To quote Joan Rivers, who doesn't love a knish? It makes sense that that's one of the epigraphs that Laura Silver has used for her new book for Brandeis University Press called simply Knish. It's a definitive biography which includes a search across three continents for the ultimate Jewish soul food. And since I, too, love knishes, I'm especially happy that Laura Silver could stop by today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The closing of special food stores is becoming a sad fact of life these days, but most people mourn and then move on. Why were you so affected by the demise of Mrs. Stahl's in Brighton Beach?
Well, it was my ancestral knish shop, and my father had gone there and his parents before him. And I didn't even realize the position it held in my, it occupied in my life.
If you'll forgive the bad pun, maybe I can draw upon the fear kashas. how were their knishes different from all other knishes?
or the four questions used in the Passover Seder. Well, Mrs. Stahl's knishes were different because the store was this wonderful place filled with the smell of onions and slightly clouded windows, and the knishes themselves seemed to be in a snail shape. And when you cut them open, you could see this line of dough in the middle, and it always reminded me of the ventricles of the human heart.
For those people who just arrived in New York City 5 minutes ago, how would you describe a knish?
Well, a knish is a pillow of dough stuffed most often with mashed potatoes and onions, and almost always with stories.
Do you prefer the potato knish to the kasha knish, the mushroom knish? A listener asks about Mrs. Stahl's cabbage knish.
Oh, yes.
His favorite, Howard.
My personal favorite is the kasha or buckwheat knish, but potato seems to be the most popular, kind of like vanilla ice cream. But I'm open to all flavors.
Is potato the original knish?
Well, according to my research, the first knish probably came from the Pale of Settlement in Eastern Europe. And I can't tell exactly what was in it, but the records show that it's from 1614, from a town called Krakowiec in Poland. That's the first written reference to the knish. And no filling was mentioned there, but if you think about potato history, my guess is that grains were probably in the first knish.
It is interesting that while you find bagels in Greenpoint, an area with a large Polish population, you don't find knishes. Knishes have become pretty much, as you call them in your subtitle, Jewish soul food.
Yeah, the knish, especially in New York City and urban centers in the U.S., has become really identified with Jewish food. You certainly don't have to be Jewish to like a knish, but it does appear in Polish culinary traditions in Poland. It's often used for mourning. The etymology says that knish is actually a pierogi or stuffed dumpling used for mourning or to comfort people who are bereaved. It's true, it's hard to find in Polish neighborhoods in New York, but there are what I like to call knishing cousins, other stuffed pastries, a pierogi or pierożki, something like that.
I looked up Mrs. Schwiebel, the queen of knishes.
Yes.
She's from Romania.
Yeah, so that area. I mean, borders were always changing, but yeah.
Now, you said this was a family tradition, but you say that after your grandmother died, you stopped going to Brighton Beach?
I did. For a while, it was too much. I mean, that area was really laden with memories, and it was hard for me to go back. But when I did, I went directly to Mrs. Stahl's, because that, even more than a cemetery, was a place to conjure memories of my grandmother and memories that even preceded her.
Your grandmother's name was Fritzi Reitel. Why did she never attempt to become a U.S. citizen?
I don't know. Her name was actually Fritzi Ridalge. As a young woman, she adopted the name Rydell, which sounded to me like the high school in Greece, so it was very funny. You know, I don't know why she didn't become a citizen, but in my research, I found out that in the census in the 1940s, she wrote as she was born in Riga, now Latvia. And on the census in the U.S., she said her place of birth was Massachusetts. So maybe that has something to do with it.
Now, you said you would go to Mrs. Stahl's every time you went back to Brighton Beach. And then one day you found that it had closed?
Yeah. It was, there were those plastic flags flapping in the wind. They're usually for a grand opening. But for me, it was really a closing of the highest order.
And what was there in its place?
A Subway sandwich shop. So if you knew Mrs. Stahl's, you knew that for almost 70 years, it stood beneath the elevated Subway. And then it became a Subway.
That shop wasn't the only place you could get Mrs. Stahl's knishes. They were sold in delis all across the city, with big signs saying, "We have Mrs. Stahl's knishes," which meant that people considered them to be something special. What happened to that?
Well, I did discuss those signs with the last owner of Mrs. Stahl's and with the distributor who would bring the knishes around. So he said after a while, the signs, just people wanted them or they fell out of favor, they would break and they weren't replaced. And when Mrs. Stahl's closed, the recipe was purchased by an Italian guy in Vineland, New Jersey, Mike Conti, who had a pasta factory, and he actually exported the knishes back to New York City. So you can still find a Mrs. Stahl's knish here and there in the five boroughs.
Has he kept up the recipe?
Yes, he is. As far as I know, he's still producing Mrs. Stahl's knishes.
Why did the original Mrs. Stahl's close? It was such a success. It was so popular, you had to wait online to get a knish.
Well, what year are you talking about there?
Maybe the last time I went.
So, I mean, Mrs. Stahl's had, there are several factors in its decline, I'd say. One was the changing population of the neighborhood in Brighton Beach, now known as Little Odessa. And to hear Les Green, the last owner of Mrs. Stahl's, tell it, he said that a lot of people moved away and would only come back once or twice a year. And from that, he couldn't make a living.
Were there other Brooklyn knishes that have moved elsewhere?
There were definitely other Brooklyn knishes, and some still exist. Shatskins and Hirsch's are with us in memory only, as far as I know. And Gabilla's, which was the original Coney Island knish, the square, yellow, fried knish, did start out first on the Lower East Side, then with the bigger factory in Williamsburg. And it, too, went into exile, I like to say, around 2006. And its factory is in Copaig, Long Island now.
Still local.
Yeah, and we've averted the great knish crisis, I'm happy to say.
Although it's not the same as Mrs. Stahl's. It's got a harder crust. We've been getting a lot of knish reminiscences online. Eddie from Queens grew up in Crown Heights, and he remembers fondly Mrs. Silva's knishes near the Carroll Movie Theater. He says everyone thought that Mrs. Silva was Phil Silver's mother.
No relation to me, by the way, that I know of, but this could be a missing link.
And I suspect he wasn't Mrs. Silva. He wasn't the, she wasn't the mother of Phil Silver's either. Another listener from the yeshiva up on the hill around Eastern Parkway in Brownsville couldn't wait till the knish man showed up during recess every day. They were 10 cents and were heaven on earth.
Wow, I wonder if that was Ruby the Knish Man. There's actually a whole website dedicated to him. And if folks have photos or other documentation that accompanies their Knish reminiscences, I'd love to see.
Now, why do you think Knishes are not as popular today as they were in the past? We love mashed potatoes. Other ethnic foods, similar kinds of ethnic foods, pizza, for example, have really just become international. Well, that did start in Italy, but the knishes started in Poland, we're assuming.
Right, Poland, I've sort of identified this corridor of knish origins in Eastern Europe.
Did you find real knishes in Poland?
I found knish-like foods for the most part, and I found a food writer who was very interested in knishes, and another one who said that knishes are traditionally served on November 1st, Day of the Dead in Poland. But I think the knish is actually poised for a renaissance in the U.S., in Poland, and beyond. because it's still a wholesome food, one that has this mark of history and something homemade, and it's a great way to break bread or break knish together.
My guest is Laura Silver, an award-winning journalist whose writing on food and culture has appeared in the New York Times, The Forward, on NPR.
Indeed.
I heard you recently on Morning, was it Morning Edition or Weekend Edition?
Weekend Edition,
talking
Sunday,
about knishes.
Yes.
Her book, Knish, In Search of the Jewish Soul Food. Do we know where the word knish comes from?
Great question. There are etymological reports from several languages. Leo Rosten, the Yiddishist, said it came from Ukrainian and Russian. In Polish etymology, I found this reference that it's the knish is a pierogi for mourning. Of course, it's linked to Yiddish, as I mentioned. So, and German, an old German also, as a food that has been pinched together, which is what I did with the knishes I made for you today.
The pierogi for mourning, of course, refers to the closing of Mrs. Stahl's.
This predated the closing of Mrs. Stahl's, if you could believe it. But that's it. Actually, even in all this research, it took me a while to realize that my own search for the knish was linked to my mourning, as was the knish itself. It was kind of uncanny when I discovered it.
Go ahead.
I should mention also that I found out that my family roots harken back to the small town in Poland near Bialystok. It's called Knishin. And that's where I found this legend of knishes being used to comfort mourners.
And, of course, Bialystok is the source of the name
Bialy. Yeah.
Do people sometimes not understand and not pronounce the K in knish?
Yes, that happens. I found a bunch of knish makers in the Midwest, ladies at the Shalom Home, who make knishes every Wednesday as a fundraiser for the senior residents. And they would sell them at the state fair, where people would come and ask for a knish or sometimes a kiss.
The name has made its way into the Oxford English Dictionary.
Amen.
Any others? Webster's? LaRousse?
Webster's. I couldn't find it in LaRousse, but I did search. I searched a lot. And it is, you know, there's some interesting linguistic links to the Aramaic language. The word kanishta is related to synagogue, and akanish, the phrase akanish, has to do with gathering, ingathering. It's similar to the word for broom. So if you think of bringing all those pieces together, and I think that's what the knish does, actually. It brings all of us together, Jewish or not, New York or not. Gives us a way to talk about what's inside.
Weren't knishes immortalized by the WPA?
Well, could you say more?
No.
yes, indeed, you're baiting me. There's a great story by Nathan Ausable, which I found in the Municipal Archives not too far from here. And he wrote this story called The King of Knishes about Yonah Schimmel.
Now, Yonah Schimmel right now is probably the closest to an old-fashioned, authentic knish that you can get in this area.
Right. And you're talking about Yonah Schimmel's The Store.
Houston Street.
Exactly, on Houston. Now, just to note that
right
Nathan,
down the street from Russin Daughters. So if you want authentic food, they're about two blocks apart.
Knish and fish, old-time friends. But I will say that Nathan Ausable, the folklorist, wrote actually about the original Yonah Schimmel, the man, who was purportedly a rabbi. But yes, Yonah Schimmel's exists. It has a dumbwaiter. It has a whole array of knishes. They're made on site, sent around the country.
So at least Yonah Schimmel's is out there to show us what a knish could taste like. There was a folk singing trio called Love and Knishes?
Yes.
What kinds of songs did they sing?
Well, this woman, Bonnie Abrams, wrote a great song about Ruby's knishes. You read about this reminiscence of a pushcart in Brooklyn, a guy selling knishes after school, and Ruby immortalized him with a song about, Bonnie Abrams immortalized Ruby with this song about how delicious his knishes were.
Well, the rhyme is right there. You've given us Mrs. Stahl's potato knish recipe. How hard is it to make?
Not hard at all. I made some this morning. Just requires a little planning and a little tiny bit of upper arm strength. Not too much. It's good to roll out the dough.
Just a pretty simple array of ingredients. The assembly is the important part?
Yeah, the dough is very simple. It's actually a vegan recipe. It's basically flour and water with some seasonings. And the filling is up to you. I have a recipe for a potato, but you could put almost anything you'd like in a knish.
And you mentioned earlier you brought in some knishes that you'd made.
Correct.
So do you think you? How do you think your Knish is compared to Mrs. Stahl's?
Well, I got a great response here at the station, and I was trained by Mrs. Stahl's granddaughters.
Oh, really?
And yes, in San Francisco, I flew out there to have a Knish apprenticeship, and they gave me the seal of approval. The one tip I'll share with you is that the dough should be paper thin, thin enough to read my book through, actually.
A caller remembers in the 1930s and 40s, Wolman's sold Knishes made out of phyllo pastes.
Hmm. Where was that, Wolman's?
I don't know. Somebody just
someone
called
else
in
has
with that.
Contacted me with Wolman's. And again, this is great because it's helpful to reconstitute the historic Knish map of New York City and beyond.
If you were to just want to buy Knishes, where do you go now?
Well, you have an array. There's an array of choices in New York. You mentioned, of course, Jonas Schimmel's. There's Knish Nosh in Queens. Gabilla's you can purchase on a street cart
or
by mail order. Costco Fresh Direct has Knishes. Pastrami Queen on the Upper East Side, if you'd like a kosher Knish. Russ and Daughter's new shop has Knishes. Really, you have Liebman's up in the Bronx. More than I can count on my 10 fingers.
Laura Silver will be speaking, and there'll also be a Knish tasting at Powerhouse on 8th Avenue in Park Slope tomorrow night at 6:30. What has been the response to this book? I told you that a lot of listeners wrote in their reminiscences. Do you think that you've opened up a nostalgia craze here?
Yes, I think we've reached the Knish tipping point, and I welcome all stories.
Well, I'll have another kasha.
Okay.
Because we're going to go into the news, so I won't be eating on the air. Laura Silver has written for the New York Times, The Forward. She's been on NPR. Her book, Knish, In Search of the Jewish Soul Food, is published by Brandeis. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.